is CBS Eye on the World. Here's John Batchelor.
Telegraph, London. U.S. to send high-tech nuclear weapons to NATO bases amid rising tensions with Russia. The lead tells us very specifically the new B-61-12 thermonuclear bombs are, quote, dial-a-yield, end quote, devices, meaning their payload can be changed. They are expected to be sent to NATO bases within weeks. B-61-12s, the report goes on, have four yields that can be selected: 0.3 kiloton, 1.5 kiloton, 10 kiloton, or 50 kilotons. The bomb dropped on Hiroshima in 45 had a yield of about 15 kilotons. The 12-foot-long weapons feature new tail kits that allow them to be dropped from planes as dumb gravity bomb or in guided drop mode with an accuracy of within 30 meters. Wow. I welcome Anatole Levin of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft to comment on this and the other ironies on the day that Vladimir Putin, his remarks at the Valdai conference each year, the 19th annual meeting this year in Moscow, made it very clear that he does not intend to use nuclear weapons on the same day that NATO is deploying them to Europe. Anatole, the ironies runneth over the edge of the ability to keep up with this. So did you expect the U.S. to make a show of sending our latest nuclear bombs, dial-a-kiloton bombs, to Europe? Good evening to you.
Hello, John. No, I must say I didn't expect that, partly because there is a possibility or a risk from NATO's point of view that this could seriously spook the West Europeans and the Germans in particular. Now, it may be that I'm just too old, but I do remember, you know, in the 70s and early 80s, how the anti-nuclear movement in Europe, including the at least the parents of the present generation of Greens and Socialists, was, you know, really agitated by the American and NATO plan to deploy Pershing intermediate range nuclear missiles in Europe. So this, I mean, it's obviously a warning to Russia. Whether it's a necessary warning, because, I mean, obviously Russia, the Russian government knows what it would be risking by using nuclear weapons in Ukraine. But one of the things it wouldn't be risking directly by using nuclear weapons in Ukraine would be the use of American nuclear weapons, because that would, I mean, if they were used tactically against the Russians in Ukraine, it would be a little ironical, to put it mildly, because America would be dropping nuclear weapons into Ukraine. On the other hand, if America dropped them into Russia, that would be the end of the world, really. Basically,
well, we're looking at a story that keeps growing and escalating. And before we get into the details of Mr. Putin's remarks, the escalatory language. Now, history says that that is a necessary predicate. That's how human beings convert themselves into something as horrible as war. Do you measure this continued dialogue? We have nukes, you have nukes, we're going to deploy them, you're going to deploy them. Is this escalatory? Is this bluff? Is this bully behavior? How do you measure it? Because you're in Europe. You're in the battle zone itself.
Well, I think it is getting close to what we used to call brinkmanship. I mean, the essence of brinkmanship is that it is, of course, about bluff. Nobody wants to end the world. Both as endless studies, but also as the example of the Cuba Missile Crisis show us. I mean, the problem about brinkmanship is that you can fall off the brink. The closer you get to the edge, the greater the risk that you're going to fall off the edge. I am afraid that we could be heading in that direction. Although, in the end, it will be decided by what happens on the battlefield in Ukraine. If the Russian army manages to hold the Ukrainians, then there is no reason for Russia to resort to nuclear weapons. But many Russians have told me that if the Ukrainians break through and look as if they're actually going to reconquer Crimea, then they say Russia not merely could but should use nuclear weapons. They compare it to America using, you know, that America would use nuclear weapons to defend Hawaii and Pearl Harbor. So I think if that happens, we will get close to the edge. Although there are other possibilities. I mean, Putin has hinted at Russia's, you know, ability to destroy Western satellites. And of course, we would then destroy Russian satellites, but that would not lead directly to nuclear war. It would cause, of course, colossal economic disruption, you know, to every service depending on satellite communications. So that is another way that we could go. But the fact that people are talking about this kind of exchange between the two nuclear superpowers, you know, is by definition worrying, right?
Yes, I go to the Telegraph summary of the speech. I don't have the transcript here. They note that this was one of the longest speeches since the beginning of the crisis. Mr. Putin took questions afterwards, too. He was sitting in an armchair, well, sort of an oversized armchair, with a correspondent asking him questions, and then the audience asked him questions. Very much a display of a man in a commercial world, not a military frame whatsoever. But he did say, this is summary out of London, the world faced the most dangerous decade since World War II. He also went on to say that he has no intention of nuclear weapons, but he accused Liz Truss, the former prime minister of Britain, of threatening Russia with nuclear attacks when she was prime minister. So let's just stop there. Mr. Putin is talking about nuclear weapons on the stage in Valdai. He's denying that he's going to use them. He started this conversation many weeks ago by talking about, as I recall, their strategic nuclear weapon, Satan II. So what is your measure of how he's using this nuclear talk? He's sustaining it, now denying it, but he keeps it in front of his own public as well as ours.
Well, I mean, he's obviously trying to raise anxiety in the West and also to warn the Ukrainians to stop at a certain point, you know, to suggest that they've taken, you know, enough and can now afford to stop because you know, they should be afraid that something much worse should happen. But he doesn't want to threaten that absolutely directly. So he's hinting at it and suggesting it. But of course, behind this also lies the fact that, you know, the Russian conventional armed forces have behaved really pretty miserably in Ukraine. The only area in which Russia can still claim to be a superpower is in nuclear weapons. So there's an obvious temptation to stress those, given that, frankly, everything else has failed.
The concern also is the negotiating table. In Mr. Putin's remarks, he said that Moscow was ready for talks to end the conflict, but he said Kyiv was not prepared to sit down at the negotiating table. This is a quote. "It's not a question about us. We're ready for negotiations. But the leaders in Kyiv decided not to continue negotiations with Russia. It's very easy to solve this problem," said Mr. Putin, "if Washington gives a signal to Kyiv to change its position and solve the problem peacefully." Translate that. He wants Washington to deliver a peace treaty that Kyiv will sign. Is that what he's thinking of?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, the thing is, he is correct in one thing, which is that the Ukrainian government in recent months has stated repeatedly and officially, and has even issued a legal decree that it's impossible to negotiate with the Putin government. And Kyiv has also said that, you know, the territorial issues are non-negotiable. So he's correct in saying that officially the Ukrainian government has ruled out talks. He wants Washington to step in and propose some sort of compromise peace. But of course, in saying that it would be easy to end this conflict, that is very, very far from being the truth. And Putin has made it even less easy by his annexation, you know, his declaration of the annexation of Ukrainian territory. Although, on the other hand, Putin has said that the borders of the annexed territories could be negotiable, which suggests that, you know, he is prepared for a territorial compromise, but obviously only a territorial compromise that leaves Russia in control of at least some of the Ukrainian territory that it has occupied.
He was name-checking the allies or the people that he regards as important on his side. One, of course, is the General Secretary of the Chinese Communist Party, Xi Jinping. Another, he points to repeatedly mentioning Europe, talking about Europe, is the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia as welcome in Moscow. Maybe that's trash-talking Washington, or maybe it's reminding everyone that this is not an us versus them anymore. There are many, many parts of the world, as we've discussed before, Anatole, I'm just reminding our listeners, there are many parts of the world who have not taken a moral or political or financial position whatsoever in this conflict. Most of Africa, most of South America, and all of the Middle East, to my knowledge. Is that a consideration in Europe, that Europe is not being joined by many of its trading partners?
Well, it ought to be. And of course, the countries that have not joined in sanctions against Russia include India, which is a principal American partner now in Asia. So it's not true that Russia is isolated on the world stage. It's isolated from America and American allies. On the other hand, of course, I think so far it's not correct really to say that any of these countries are allied to Russia, because the Chinese, you know, have not sided against Russia, but they haven't given any concrete aid to Russia. No substantial financial aid, no military aid, or at least hardly any that's noticeable. So the Chinese are, you know, still being quite cautious. And Chinese with whom I've spoken have said, you know, we really did not approve this war. We didn't want this war to happen. Also, as one of them said, you know, Russia and the Russian government have lost considerable respect in China because of their failures. And we're never going to recognize the Russian annexations, because that goes totally against our entire international legal position. So Russia is not isolated, but it doesn't really have much, you know, actual support either, except, of course, in terms of buying Russian oil and gas, which everyone now desperately needs.
You're in Germany sometimes, and Germany is always a concern for the rest of Europe. The puzzle about Germany now is, having walked away from Us Politik, is it now finding a way to deal with Beijing as a surrogate for Us Politik? And is that a way of dealing with Russia? This is the most important economy in Europe. This is the manufacturing giant of Europe. This is the banking center of Europe. Is it changing its approach to the war in Ukraine now after 8 months?
Well, there are under the surface some quite serious tensions in the German government. The Green Foreign Minister Annalena Baerbock, somewhat paradoxically for a party that began as pacifists, is taking a very hard line both against Russia and against China. The Chancellor Olaf Scholz and his Social Democratic Party, they're not very softer on Russia, but they are very unwilling to take a hard line against China, because, as some of them have said to me, look, a severe hit from the cutoff of Russian gas. If on top of that we join the Americans in, you know, cutting off technological exports to China, then you risk, you know, actually, you know, driving German industry into the ground. And we're not going to do that, at least not if we can possibly help it. And one of the things they're afraid of course, is if they do that, you could see a popular revolt in Germany and a huge surge in support, both the extreme left and the extreme right. So they have good reasons, you know, to be worried.
The opinions are changing of the war in Ukraine. I'm speaking with Anatole Levin of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. When we come back, Congress, is it changing its mind about Ukraine? I'm John Batchelor.